From the Spec Network, this is Fragmented, an Android developer podcast where we talk about building good software and becoming better Android developers. I'm Don Felker.
And I'm Kaushik Gopal.
Welcome to the show.
In this episode, we resume our conversation with Airbnb's Gabriel Peel. If you haven't listened to part one, you really, really should go back and do that. In that episode, we kicked it off by first trying to understand the goals and the story behind why React Native was chosen as the code-sharing technology or tool. In this episode, Gabriel tells us why, after 2 years, 220 screens, and 120,000 lines of JavaScript code, they're finally moving away from React Native. Listen on.
So, sounds like you had a lot of good things that did happen with React Native overall in general. But I do remember speaking to you even back in 2017 about some of the issues and some of the things that you had problems with React Native development. And at the time, and this has since passed, at the time you had recently just completed a major upgrade that took quite a while. And so, other than that, you know, long tail issue, which took you a while to update, what things didn't really go so well for you with React Native that's kind of off the top of your head?
Sure. And for the record, that update, it had to do with a single instance last year where for a series of React Native releases, Facebook internally, when they work with React Native and React, they basically develop off of master. Everything, every commit basically hits all their platforms, and that's what they're working off of. Whereas they release these discrete releases to the public on a monthly cadence. So there was a series of releases last year where the stable version of React Native was targeting a beta version of React 16. And that in and of itself wasn't a major problem. React itself was pretty stable. The problem then was third-party libraries, where you had third-party libraries specified which versions of React they were compatible with. And the JavaScript community likes to target only stable versions of libraries for consistency across the ecosystem. And so since we were using a lot of JavaScript libraries, which from their perspective are probably used 99% on web, it wasn't a priority for them to add support for React 16 beta, or in some cases was actually against their philosophy. And so the entire React Native community was kind of screwed over for a while, where they couldn't upgrade React Native because their dependencies were not compatible with the new version of React beta. So that was a one-time instance. I think a lot of people screamed with good reason, and hopefully Facebook doesn't do that again. But that was just one of a number of things that sort of come along with working on the bleeding edge of an ecosystem. But if we just start, you know, think about some of the other things that were challenging for us. One of them was maybe not even React Native specific, but the fact that we had a typed system on one side of our app and then an untyped system on the other. And I think coming from the web community, if you're used to React, this may not be such a jarring change. It's exactly the same as what you'd be used to on web. But I think for a lot of mobile developers who are used to these strongly typed systems or the incredible power of IntelliJ, switching to React Native, which is untyped, and especially like a younger code base, with which many people were more or less learning JavaScript for the first time, was a bit challenging. So we definitely saw some crashes both in development but also in production, where some sort of JavaScript refactoring would cause regressions that were hard to test, where there'll be subtle differences like an onClick property maybe not getting past the right parameters or not getting renamed in one additional place. So we definitely saw some challenges there.
Quick follow-up to that. So I'm curious, what IDE did you use? So in order to work on the Airbnb app, did that mean you had like VS Code for like some of the React Native portion, but you also had IntelliJ for the native portion, or were you just using IntelliJ together? Just out of curiosity, because I'm sure that's something that people would be wondering.
Yeah, so earlier on, I think it was more of a Wild West, like use whatever you want. But then as it started to mature, I think we started to unify around VS Code. We didn't tell anyone they couldn't use anything else, but we started to provide a list of suggested plugins, IDE configuration, and we found that VS Code worked extremely well for us.
Nice.
And then, so I was talking about types before, and some people are obviously going to be thinking about some options on React, like Flow and TypeScript. And so I should note that we did try Flow early on, but we found that the error messages were quite cryptic or academic, talking about covariance and contravariance when these random places. And if you really study and read up on it, they are in fact accurate and you can understand what they mean. But we found that for people just trying to get their work done and learn a new platform, it was overwhelming for them. It also, its type inference is also extremely advanced, and it's, again, academically correct. But what happens when you incrementally introduce it to a code base or potentially maybe type something not exactly right, because it's quite an advanced and complicated type system. The flow, by nature of its name, it will flow through your code and will start to infer types in a lot of places. But then it will break because some type didn't match, but the location in which its type inference breaks may not actually indicate the actual source of the problem of the type. And so you can wind up with, in a large code base where you may be unfamiliar with different parts, you can wind up in a situation where your type system is broken and you have no idea why. So that was difficult with Flow. And then TypeScript introduced its own challenges because it's unlike Flow, which is just basically like a layer on top of JavaScript. TypeScript is not technically JavaScript itself. It's technically a different language. There are some underlying differences, and it has to be compiled or transpiled back into JavaScript in order to run. And it was not compatible with the Metro Bundler tooling system that we used.
Interesting. You said something that was also that caught my attention is that some folks were coming into React Native having to learn JavaScript. Maybe they've never really played with it or just kind of toyed with it here and there. I can imagine that they had some troubles with some of the weird inconsistencies that JavaScript has around itself, and then could also kind of lead to problems in regards to debugging it because they don't understand the language. Did you find that some developers had those issues at all?
Yes. And some of the issues we have with JavaScript go a little bit beyond just the language itself, because we could talk for weeks probably about the pros and cons of JavaScript and all of its idiosyncrasies. Use Google. You can find all kinds of stuff on the internet. But there are some React Native specific bits that I think are worth pointing out. So if you run JavaScript in a browser, you run on the JavaScript engine in the browser. It's a similar story for React Native, where on iOS, there's a JavaScript core. It ships with the iPhone, and that it's consistent across all iOS devices. The Android platform itself does not have a shared JavaScript core, and so you have to bundle one with your app itself. And the JavaScript core actually runs the JavaScript, and it's what gives you, when there are new language features, they get added to these JavaScript core runtimes so that it knows how to interpret new JavaScript code. So this has a couple side effects. One, when we wrote our code, we had to run it through Babel, which basically takes the JavaScript and it transpiles it and it does a bunch of optimizations, or it replaces some of the new JavaScript ES6 features with more compatible ones that run on a wider variety of JavaScript runtimes, and it spits out JavaScript again at the end. The JavaScript then runs, again, on iOS would be the JavaScript core, but then on Android, since it doesn't ship with one, you actually have to package a JavaScript core with your app. And so this, for the most part, is not a huge problem. React Native ships with one, but the one that Facebook ships, at least as of about 6 months ago, is extremely old, on the order of like multiple years old.
Oh, no.
And so the ecosystem has moved further than that. There have been performance improvements, they've added some support for some new language features. So there's actually a project, which I think we can link to in the show notes, where you can package a newer version of the JavaScript core. That being said, it gets more complicated still, because when you're running React Native on a phone, your JavaScript is running on that JavaScript core that you packaged. But you use the Chrome debug tools. to debug any React Native app. It's a powerful debugger. You can do breakpoints. You have a REPL. You can view your React component tree. You can look at Redux state. You can do a variety of different things. But when you're debugging, it's actually running that JavaScript inside of Chrome itself.
Causes
a couple of problems.
Okay, so there's inconsistencies there again. And exactly. Chrome probably ships with like the new spanking new thing, right?
Exactly. So when you're talking about Heisenbugs, you get the ultimate Heisenbugs, where it doesn't or it does work on your phone. You start debugging, and it does or it doesn't work there, and you get different results, and it can cause you to pull your hair out because it is literally a Heisenbug in its truest form. Yeah. So we saw this once where I think it was two locale string. We were using that for some a currency format or something like that, where it worked on iOS, but it only worked on Android while debugging. And it turns out that the JavaScript core that we were using on Android didn't compile some internationalization package because it's very large, but it was just silently failing. So there are some gotchas with React Native where everything is fine, and then you hit something like this, and unfortunately the engineer who encountered this had to spend days debugging and trying to figure out what's going on. And unless you have this context and you have the time to really debug into it, it really highlights another major issue with React Native where everything might be going swimmingly well, and then you hit this one thing that is unexpected and you would think would be trivial, like formatting a currency and adding the commas to a number. And then you have to spend days in order to get that working.
So just so I understand, so listeners get this. So when the engineer tried the tool locale and was debugging, he's like, hey, let me see why this thing is not working. As she or he would debug this error, it would work perfectly well because the actual engine being used is from Chrome. But what would happen is when you run it on your phone or in production, it would not work the same way.
Absolutely.
Oh, man.
Yes.
That's enough to drive you crazy.
Man, that's exactly the point where I would just like flip a table and take like a week off or something. Yeah. I was like, I don't get it. Like, I don't not, like, nothing works anymore.
Yes, it certainly gave the people who were more skeptical of React Native some more ideas to chew on.
So along the same line, so we talked about debugging. What about like, how do you monitor crashes? Because I remember hearing this thread where folks would say like, oh, like, you know, you would need like Crashlytics Native or something if you use Crashlytics. Because I remember this conversation offhand, like, you know, when I was talking to another developer. How does crash monitoring work? Are you able to use the same tool? I read in your blog post that you don't use Crashlytics, but you use like Bugsnag. But do you have to handle that independently from React Native? Does that work with the existing ecosystem? Is it all Android or is it like Android iOS? Can you like talk us through how crash monitoring basically works?
Yeah, so we do use Bugsnag for our primary crash monitoring, both on Android and iOS. We built up some infrastructure where it's initialized with the app. We obviously package the SDK. And we were able to use that same infrastructure for React Native. So our React Native crashes did in fact show up in Bugsnag alongside Android and iOS.
Oh, nice.
So they showed up on their respective platforms. It was not a third platform. They were never merged. So you can never see all React Native crashes, but they were always separated in their different Bugsnag projects. So again, they're not coalesced across projects. And that's probably with good reason where there were times where there would be a crash on one platform and not the other. That being said, it did require a little bit of additional infrastructure to make sure that things are bridged properly. We had to add some steps to our CI to upload source maps because the JavaScript does get minified. And so if you are considering using React Native, you should do some investigative research to make sure that whatever crash provider you're using does have some sort of support for React Native and uploading these separate, they were JavaScript source maps. So it was not just plug and play, but we were eventually able to leverage all of our existing infrastructure.
Some of the other things that have heard and also read on the post is that there's problems with long lists. Can you explain why long lists are a problem in React Native or some of the issues you encountered with them?
Yeah, so long lists are challenging, but thankfully both Android and iOS have really good components now to deal with them. So on Android, we have Recycler View, and then on iOS, you have UI Collection View. They're really powerful, and they're super highly optimized for performance for potentially infinitely scrolling lists. If you dig into the implementation details of, let's talk about Recycler View, since this is fragmented after all, you have something called a layout manager. You probably have seen Linear Layout Manager. That's the most common one by far. Basically, as you're scrolling, it's filling in chunks of views. Mm-hmm. And so as you're scrolling, it's like, okay, layout next chunk. You go to your adapter, and you're like, okay, what kind of view do you want to put here? And then it's like, all right, like here's your view for that, populated with some data. Then it calls layout and measure, and it figures out how tall that is. And then it like does some math to figure out how many more of those rows to lay out. Going back to the performance section from earlier, everything on React Native runs on separate threads. So now you're the Recycler View, and you're like, okay, I need this data. How do I get it? Well, you can get it synchronously. So that introduces a number of challenges, and it makes it really difficult to use something like Recycler View when you can't synchronously get the data. Similarly, on iOS, there are a lot of optimizations. If you can pre-compute the cell height of different rows in your UI collection view, and it's simply not possible with React Native, the way that it works. That being said, I know if you do read Facebook's blog post, which we link to, I think, in part 4 of our Medium series, they do talk about some of the improvements they're making, where they're going to make it much easier to synchronize things across native and JavaScript and layout. And one of the specific things that will enable is wrapping something like a Recycler View in React Native. So again, I'd say this is a problem today, but if we were to jump forward a year or a year and a half, I think that there's the potential to make major gains in this area.
So many of these things like make sense at this point, right? Like we've discussed in great detail some of like the nuances with like the technical difficulties, but a large part of also why something works or doesn't work is also sort of like, you know, the meta layer where trying to come up with like the team that like sort of like takes care of this, or you know, some of the other organizational changes, right? Can you talk a little about how that experience was? Like I imagine some of it must be good and like some of it may not have been that great, right? So did you have to like build like a cross-platform team? Was there like a React Native team that was taking care of this until like, you know, you could sort of go further with this experiment? How did all of that work?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it's something I think bears extra emphasizing that that actually figuring out the logistics of making the teamwork cross-platform with native Android iOS and React Native is extremely difficult. A lot of people on the internet, and we can touch on this later, were like, "What? I think Flutter would solve all your problems, or I think Xamarin would solve all your problems." But that they don't solve any of those, any of the organizational challenges. It's really hard to get a team that's used to writing for one platform start thinking about two or three. And so particularly one of the things we found about React Native or cross-platform frameworks in general is that, you know, they're polarizing. They have a long history. People have developed, they have spent years developing their opinions on whether cross-platform is a good concept or a bad concept, and then adding on layers of specifics for individual frameworks like React Native. So I think with a lot of technologies, they're pretty easy to experiment. You know, people may agree or disagree or be more or less excited about them, but that in and of itself wouldn't pose a major challenge. But I think one thing to be aware of when considering React Native is that people are going to feel very differently about it. And the mere ability to have a conversation around it and evaluate it is going to introduce a number of pain points in and of itself.
Out of curiosity, obviously, like, you know, the end story here with Airbnb is like they decided to like sunset React Native, right? Before we even get to this, how exactly did you start to notice that something wasn't working?
Yeah.
You know, how did that arise? Like, was it like regular sync meetings where you would like get together and they're like, hey, what's working? What's not working? And one fine day you realize that the number of points on the not working, like, you know, a column is increasing? Or how did you sense that? Because obviously, given how you know, gung-ho Airbnb was with React Native, you would think that at a certain point bias would take over and you'd be willing to like try to circumvent all problems, right? At what point did you realize, hey, maybe this isn't a great idea anymore? Especially, I just can't imagine like putting myself in that position where like so much has been invested. You've done so much for the community of React Native. Like, how do you even begin to like make that decision, you know?
Yes, that is a good question. And so if we think back to the beginning of why we set out to do React Native, we actually had some pretty explicit goals. We wanted to be able to move faster as an organization because we didn't have enough mobile engineers to achieve our goals. So we needed to move more quickly and have higher overall output. But in doing so, we wanted to make sure that we did so without sacrificing any quality. It's one of our, this Airbnb was founded by designers, and I think that that design DNA is really core to the way that we write products here, and we weren't willing to sacrifice that with React Native. We also wanted to be able to leverage the cross-platform nature of React Native, because if we weren't, then we might as well just write native. And then we wanted to do so while improving upon the developer experience. So thinking about those as our benchmark, we had to look at where we were with React Native. And I would say also it's worth noting that this was not a, there was no like light bulb moment. There was no discrete event that caused us to say, all right, time to pack it up and go home. It was a gradual decision where we were constantly evaluating our goals and we were looking ahead at the roadmap of hiring and the team and the product roadmap and new things that were coming down and to figure out, okay, what is the potential for React Native? How much investment are we putting in and what does it look like we're going to get out of it? And so for a benchmark, when we started working on React Native, we had at one point added, we probably had around 30 to 40 mobile engineers in total across Android and iOS. And then on some of the earlier projects there, we had a pretty significant React Native investment. So we probably got up to 15 to 20 React Native engineers. So It was a fairly large effort, especially while we were launching experiences in late 2016. It was very promising. That being said, our mobile team continued to grow. A lot of the existing teams continued to grow. There were a lot of new teams. Some of them chose native. Some of them chose React Native, which in and of itself is something that's not trivial to figure out. But then looking forward, we laid out the roadmap of new teams and features to see what kind of opportunities there were for React Native to grow. And towards the end of last year, we were at a point where we were crossing like 100, over 100 contributors to Android and iOS. Not all of them are full-time, but they were all contributing natively to Android and iOS. But at the same time, we were getting only about somewhere between 5 and 15 React Native engineers contributing at the same time.
Oh.
And given the bleeding edge nature of React Native itself, we had to invest a lot in that infrastructure to build bridges for everything, to try to support the product engineers so they could focus on product and not have to worry about constantly hopping between Android, iOS, and React Native. And then at a certain point, when we weighed everything, we looked at the investment and the potential for React Native to become successful and grow within the organization. We saw that we actually didn't think that it had the potential to be worth the investment that we were putting into it. So I think more than any individual technical pro or con, or maybe even organizational, at the end of the day, we knew what we were putting in and we knew the potential we had to get out of it, and it no longer made sense to continue.
Interesting. So would you say a large part of the decision was also shifted because just Airbnb started to have more mobile native engineers, and so it made sense at that point, because if more people are comfortable with something, you probably want to do that because eventually people will move faster with the things that they're comfortable in. Is that like a fair assessment, or is it slightly more nuanced than just that?
No, I think that's quite fair. I think we had a lot of engineers and having most of your platform in native, but then like every once in a while you have to hop back and forth. It adds these weird edges in the code base where you kind of, it winds up on a black box on one side or the other, or teams have to spend a lot of time trying to decide how to resource and how to hire. And then they can wind up in situations, let's say they go React Native, but then they hire mobile engineers and they can't work on certain parts of the code base within their own team. You wind up with all of these challenges such that it introduces an order of magnitude of new complexities to managers and engineers and code bases and scaling. And it's something that you really have to consider strongly how to adopt. And there really aren't clear answers. Like teams would ask us, should we use React Native for this or that? Or how should we hire? Or, you know, if someone joins the team and whatnot, these questions are not easy, and they don't have answers. They don't have clear answers, certainly. And sometimes you won't know if it is effective until after the fact.
So what, from this point forward, I imagine there's still some React Native code that's inside of the Airbnb app. Does that mean that all of your React development has stopped at this point in time? And then if so, what happens to all those existing React Native components that are in your app?
Yeah, so I would say our React Native investment started, we started to wind it down actually towards the beginning of the year, around January, February timeframe. And it's worth noting that the blog post didn't come out until now because it's super hard to take all this information and condense it down into something that tries to paint a balanced picture. But so since the beginning of the year, we basically have zero new development going on for React Native. It's important to us to support the existing screens that still run in it. So we certainly still have it in the app, but over time we have some active and long tail projects that we're working on to redesign and rewrite some of these screens that were in React Native back in Native. Certainly some of our top priority ones are the highest trafficked ones we want to get off first. Also, some of the screens that are you tend to hit early on in the app, either launch screens or screens that are accessible from one or two taps from the home screen, those are a higher priority for us as well. So then if we can shift those back to Native, we may not have to initialize React Native at app startup.
Oh, interesting. That was the drive. I thought initially the drive was also more towards, oh, those are the most primary important screens, so you want to be able to move fast and let the teams have more flexibility. I imagine that's also obviously a big part, but there is like a direct technical like root cause as well where you want to move these as quickly as possible.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Now, I know you'd also stated somewhere in the post as well that React Native, and I think it may have been on Twitter actually too, that this is not painting React Native as a bad technology. It's just that given the situation that Airbnb found itself in, you tried it as an experiment and it didn't work, but it still has valid use cases. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. I think, you know, it's really easy to look at the end decision and be like, okay, well, I guess React Native is not good enough and nobody should use it for anything. But at the end of the day, React Native is a technology, and from the post and from this conversation, I think it should be clear that it's really good at some things and it's really not good at some other things. I think it's really important to understand the mission and the challenge that you're undertaking by adopting React Native. But if you're able to build a team around it and invest in the infrastructure, and that being said, we've talked about infrastructure a fair amount, but I want to reiterate the point that React Native is not a silver bullet that prevents you from needing to know Android and iOS.
Yes.
Even if you do decide to write most of your infrastructure in JavaScript, you will 100% encounter situations where you have to dig and dive back into Android and iOS. It's super, super important, and I want that to be clear, because if you build a team that's 100% JavaScript with no Android and iOS expertise, they're going to encounter these roadblocks that are extremely challenging to fix, and they're going to be working in a language and in tools that they've never used before, and it's going to take them a long time to figure out how to build something or how to fix something.
I imagine that would like greatly complicate things for Airbnb too, right? Because like when you're hiring engineers, mm-hmm. what would you do then? Like you're like, oh, well, actually, we want you to be really good at mobile native, but we're also trying React Native. So, you know, you probably need some React Native experience as well. Or is the idea that, no, let's just find someone who's amazing at one thing and then hope they learn the other thing? Like how does that process work?
Exactly. So this story is quite interesting, and it poses yet another one of the more nuanced challenges with React Native, which is that nobody knows all three platforms in great detail. Android, iOS, and JavaScript/React are huge ecosystems. They're very complex, mm-hmm. and it takes a long time and a huge investment to learn them. There are good luck finding a unicorn that can very effectively work in all three platforms. So what that means is, even though you have to work in all three platforms sometimes with React Native, so either you find the perfect balance where everyone can help each other just the perfect amount, or you wind up with people working in a platform that they're not super familiar with. The other side of the coin for this is that one thing that happens in the internet is it's basically a giant game of telephone. So we say at Airbnb, we do some conference talks to talk about React Native on Twitter, and people are like, oh, okay, React Native, Airbnb uses React Native. And then that circles around for a while. And then somehow through this game of telephone, it turns into Airbnb only does React Native, or their app is 100% React Native. Now, this is not something that we've ever said, and it's never been even close to true. In fact, except for one brief period where React Native was close to 50% of the internal mobile engineering we did, for the vast majority of its life, it was closer to 10 or 15%. So it's something really important to keep in mind, and considering how polarizing it is, there will definitely be engineers who may interpret it this way and then discount the potential of working at your company as a result. So this is something that we're dealing with and we're trying to understand. It's impossible to understand the exact impact that this had, but we've certainly already talked to people who weren't considering Airbnb simply because they thought we were 100% React Native and are now considering it again, because now they're like, oh, but Android and iOS, that's an option for me. So something really important to consider to make sure if you're going to do React Native, this is something that may happen to you too.
Oh, wow. That's crazy. So what you're saying is the perception was like, oh, you know, there's more React Native that's being done. So you're not hiring like native. So I don't think I have a place in here.
Exactly. Or, I mean, honestly, and for, like I said, React Native is polarizing. So, you know, there are people out there who may see React Native as a sign that mobile is a second-class citizen, or we don't take product quality seriously because it's a cross-platform framework. So without, you know, diving into any of the specifics or understanding anything further, I think there will always be people who will straight up discount anything cross-platform or React Native at its surface without going any further. So that is just the state of the world.
I think it's also important. You said something really important there, that folks think that you're doing all of the development in one platform, but then the hiring component is the big one here. And I think it should also be evaluated for other folks too, that are even in smaller organizations. I've seen teams want to start with React Native or Xamarin or some whatever their favorite tool of the month is. And what they've ended up finding is it's very hard to find folks that know these things, and it loops back to knowing both platforms. And eventually, if you do find that unicorn that knows how to work on both, to kind of work on your app or your side project or your small startups app that you've written in one of these things, you're going to find that these unicorns that are out there are very expensive. And so it's something to also keep in mind if you're thinking about, hey, it may be cheap now. You're also going to have to think about, hey, is if I'm not going to be developing this in 6 months to a year, we have to hire someone to do that, how hard is it going to be able to find someone to do that? And is it going to be affordable or not?
Absolutely. And but that being said, of all the platforms, React Native is still probably the easiest because you can tap into the React expertise of the world, but which would not be the case for Flutter, Xamarin, NativeScript, whatever other cross-platform framework you may be considering. But even with React Native, you have these other challenges that I mentioned.
So speaking of Flutter, is that something that has crossed your team's mind since you've now decided to move on from React Native? Has your team considered Flutter or anything like that?
Yeah, Gabriel, what's wrong with Flutter?
I'm not here to hate on Flutter, but no, this is not something we're actively pursuing. It's actually quite interesting to me, the number of people on the internet who have responded to these posts saying, well, what about Flutter? It's going to solve all your problems. Or what about Xamarin? You wouldn't have any problems with Xamarin. Something particular, the Xamarin lovers of the world are particularly vocal and adamant that it has no problems and it's perfect, which I find interesting. Flutter sounds great. I've heard really good things about it. I know that they've put a lot of work into the developer experience and having the ability to build these high quality apps. That being said, I think that with all the organizational challenges that we've outlined, and also just riding the wake of React Native, and we still have it in our code base, and we're just winding down the infrastructure investment on that, I think we need a little break across the platform. That being said, who knows what will happen in the future, and we do love Kotlin here at Airbnb, and I know Kotlin Native is fairly new, and it's a really exciting piece of technology. Where we think it's still very, very early for Kotlin Native, but we're excited to keep an eye on it and see where the community starts to head with Kotlin Native. So maybe ask us again in like a year, but I think for now, we're just going to take a step back and really make Android and iOS amazing.
the question I was going to follow up with again was like, say you didn't start with the React Native piece and Flutter was something that was like developing at that point. Do you think this was still an investment you would have made? Like, how much of it was like the cross-platform aspect of like making that easier? And how much of it was, well, we already have like this huge swath of people who know React, so maybe it might be easier. How much, or also like if you're saying Kotlin Native is something that like you're interested in, right? Where does that driving decision come from? Like when, at what point do you think like, oh, it's worth investing in experimenting in this? Or do you just never stop? Do you always just keep going on?
Yeah, that's a good question. And yeah, and I think from the outside, when you look at a company, tech or non-tech, and you see a decision made, you have a picture of this major investment where you lay out all the options and everything is this like highly orchestrated top-down decision. But in reality, it's normally just somebody decides that we should invest in something. And that being said, that decision can come from a place where they've evaluated a lot of options, but it generally, these decisions often come bottom up. So in the case for React Native at Airbnb, there were two engineers, Leland Richardson and Spike Brehm, in early to mid 2016. They're both extremely talented React and web engineers with a lot of experience. They had less mobile experience coming in, but they saw the needs of the organization needing more mobile investment. And they knew their own expertise and knew that as a company, we've invested an incredible amount into React and our React infrastructure. And so it made React Native specifically a really good fit. So I think it came specifically from the React direction more so than this desire to use a cross-platform framework.
So I guess we've sort of like gone through the process, right? Like we understood where, like, you know, why the investment was made. We understood what went well, what didn't go well. It looks like Airbnb has something brewing up again. Like even though you're saying like you'd like to take some time off, like you do have a very clear vision of where you want to be headed, especially since I imagine there are a lot of lessons that were learned having used React Native, right? So what exactly is the idea now? Like what does a mobile engineer at Airbnb now look forward to, or like what is, you know, what's in the pipeline?
Yeah, that is a good question. It's hard to even know where to begin. We're working on a ton of stuff in the mobile space. And to be clear, we never stopped. We now have even more resources in Native, which we're excited about. But, you know, some of the things, obviously, Kotlin has been huge for the industry. We were so excited about it. We actually, fun fact, we did our first Kotlin pilot in October 2015. So we love Kotlin here. We were then held back a bit with Buck, which had some issues with Kotlin, but since they've been resolved, we now are almost 100% of new code is in Kotlin, which is great. But one of the neat things about Kotlin is that it's not just syntactic sugar on top of Java. The way the language constructs and some of the language features like type extensions and delegates actually enable you to build new types of frameworks. So if you read part 5 of this Medium series, you'll see a code snippet under a section called Mavericks. This is a new library we're working on internally that we're planning on open sourcing in the near future that basically takes some of the functional reactive style of React, where you have a state and then a UI that basically just is a dummy render of the state, combined with Epoxy, which is sort of, you can write it with a Kotlin DSL in such a way that it feels quite similar to JSX or a DSL in code for creating screens, paired with a number of other things we've built internally to build a screen that is functionally reactive. It's Kotlin. It's quite beautiful. In fact, if you look at the code snippet, you'll notice you can build screens without having to worry about the Android lifecycle, without having to worry about sharing, like how to store things to share state between screens, without having to resubscribe to network requests or cancel them on rotation or anything like that. So we're trying to take some of these things which were not problems in React Native and solve them using really nice Kotlin DSLs and Kotlin language features to bring some of the nice developer experience wins back to Native. That being said, we are not trying to shoehorn React Native back into Native. We just think that there are some paradigms and some things that did, in fact, work really well with React Native, and we want to take some of the ideas behind them and create a good developer experience.
So you threw a couple of like very interesting terms, and I mean, because of, for folks who have read the blog post, it makes sense, but maybe listeners haven't. So let's maybe like dive just quickly into like some of that. You mentioned epoxy. What exactly is epoxy?
Yeah, so epoxy is an open source library written by Eli Hart, an engineer here, that we open sourced around when we started talking about DLS, that our design language system externally, in which you create your view, you can annotate it with some epoxy things, and then it basically creates this it almost like a view holder that's compatible with a special recycler view adapter, so that if you have a list of views on your screen, often in many cases heterogeneous. So let me take a step back, actually. So often when people think of recycler view, they think of something like a contact list or a feed of fairly homogeneous items. But if you actually look at most screens in most apps, they are a list of some sort. They're probably pretty heterogeneous, so you have a variety of different things. And doing that out of the box with recycler view is quite challenging. You have to create all your view types and all your view holders, and you have to, it becomes quite awkward, and you have to kind of shuffle your code around in order to have it be in a recycler view.
Oh yeah, the boilerplate is pretty immense, yeah.
Exactly. And even the goal of putting in a recycler view may not be clear, but let's say you had it in a linear layout, your whole screen is going to render when you first look at the page. But if it's in a recycler view, you essentially get lazy rendering of screens. So we wanted the ability to basically turn every screen into a recycler view without all of that boilerplate. So epoxy lets you create essentially a component for a view that is automatically backed by a view holder and stuff like that, so that in your recycler view, you basically, or in your adapter, you return a list of components, and it automatically does all the recycler view magic behind the hood, under the hood.
And along with epoxy, you mentioned Mavericks, and I thought that's actually a pretty cool name. I didn't even know that's like the code name for how you call it, but MVRX, you know, as we have MVVM, MVI, there's MVRX, and I guess, can you give us, can you briefly talk to us about that?
Yeah, so to preface this, I think I've read more articles and listened to more podcasts than my brain can handle of different MVI, MVVM, MVC, MVP, and it makes my head spin. And like, honestly, like, I'm not even going to think about like throwing another, like one of those acronyms on it, because it doesn't really matter. I think some people love to get into the nitty-gritty nuanced differences between the different paradigms. I don't care to have those conversations. I just want to build something that enables people to build a product and really quickly and easily at super high quality. So I've been at Airbnb for about 3 years now, and me and some of my coworkers, we looked at how people were building products, and we start to see patterns emerge of they need shared data between screens. They use epoxy components, there's a toolbar. Sometimes the toolbar is like white, sometimes it's dark. We saw a bunch of these patterns, and we wrapped them all up in a collection such that all of the boilerplate and all the little things that are repeated, that you're turning the crank when you're writing on a new screen, we just wanted to make that as easy as possible. And in doing so, we were able to leverage some of the new things from Google, like the architecture components, which Mavericks heavily relies on. Also, Kotlin and some of its language features allowed us to make the API for this extremely elegant and easy to work with. And so we started with a pilot with a couple teams where we worked with them to evolve the API and to make it really easy to use. And then we started to expand it to more teams. And the goal is not to come up with this like highly philosophical framework that you have to like teach to someone and explain, but more to create a tool set and a set of APIs where you can be like, this is how you build a product. And if there's any challenges in building your product, let's just fix the API. Let's clean it up. Let's make something that's just focused on building things.
So I hear you. I understand completely. But it also does feel in some ways, aren't you actually creating something new that you also again have to learn? Because it isn't, at what point, you know, because this is like the common, like, you know, to play devil's advocate, the common paradigm always is like, well, in the end, if you go through all of this, like the stuff that the Android framework provides, yeah, there's like some pain associated with it. But like you rightly said, like you can't not learn those things. So you have to learn those things anyway. At what point can, I guess I'm trying to understand, like, you know, it's easy to come up with something on your own again all over. But at what point do you make that decision where like, no, actually it makes sense this time?
Yeah. And I think, again, it's sort of an organic process where it's about a lot of what software engineering is pattern recognition. Like you've seen the screen before, or you see people building the same things over and over again. So it didn't come out of this need where like, oh, let's build a MVP framework for Airbnb, just like everybody else. We're like, hey, everyone is making a screen with epoxy and a toolbar and a footer, and you know these, and they're trying. They like to share state, so they build like this custom data controller class across that they can share across their different fragments. These are patterns that everyone is kind of doing on their own, and they're half reinventing the wheel each time, or they're writing the boilerplate. They have to make a new layout. They have to make like a shell activity to host their fragment and like do your fragment transaction, check if save instance state is null in order to do the fragment transaction. Like there's all these little things that you have to do. And we're just like, let's just take all of those and like wrap them up in a nice box and put a bow on it so that they can focus on the product. So again, the Mavericks, it's not a fundamentally new paradigm. It doesn't boil the ocean. It just takes all of these little things that people do over and over again, and it wraps them up.
And where did the functional reactive piece come in from there? Was that primarily just because of seeing how React works and like maybe the Redux portion of like React Native? Was that how like it's sort of like, oh, maybe we should adapt something like that?
Yeah, so one of the... A common source of bugs on Android is you have like a network request, and then you save the response to a field in your class, and then you have all this other state is loading, whatever. You just kind of sprinkle all this stuff around, and like the network request comes back, and you like update that one view that has to deal with a network request, and you wind up with a spaghetti code where it's extremely easy for the view to become in an inconsistent state. Or if you want to actually build the nice touches of your user interface, like having the appropriate loading spinners in the right places, you have to add all of this logic and tie everything together in awkward ways. So, but with React, you have props and state. Super simple. It's basically the analogous thing in Kotlin would be a data class. It's a class, it contains some object, and there's a render function. This render function it should be a pure function, which means it takes the props and state as the input, and then it returns the render tree as the output. And we have the same concept in Mavericks plus Epoxy, where basically Mavericks says you have a view model. It's, again, the Android architecture component view model. It's generic on a state data class. And this data class is the only output of that view model. Your fragment, which is kind of like a view, it subscribes to it. And every time the state changes, it calls build models, which is kind of the Epoxy equivalent of render in React.
Right.
And that function, again, should be like a pure function. It takes the state from your view models, and it spits out a list of components. Those components then get bound under the hood to views and epoxy with automatic diffing.
God.
And so it'll actually, on a background thread, it'll actually basically coalesce your components, and it'll actually send individual recycler view calls to notify item moved, changed, removed, added, whatever it may be, so that you get a super efficient screen that's literally only re-rendering what's changing.
Nice. That's pretty cool. Yeah, a large portion of like these newer MVI kind of architectures do a similar thing, but the only difference is a lot of the output is the view state, right? Which is, I'm not sure if it's exactly the view model. And then it's the piece that hasn't yet been figured out yet by a lot of these patterns is like, oh, how do you do the diffing, right? Or like, how do you do the rendering, so to speak, and using the same terminology that you use. But it seems like this also combining epoxy, like you're actually done, the output is basically something that epoxy can like directly consume, which is what I think makes it even nicer in terms of like avoiding even more boilerplate. And you're also getting the advantages of a lot of the performance benefits, right?
Exactly. And again, all of these things, they leverage existing tools. So like, For this diffing, like it leverages stable IDs on RecyclerView, and then it does a diffing, and then it dispatches normal RecyclerView calls and lets it handle what it does best, and Epoxy does what it does best. And it's a matter of just taking together things that individually work really well for a specific problem and making them all work really well together.
This this is a lot of interesting stuff, and I'm actually pretty excited by seeing like some of the stuff. It's also nice in general to know that there are like certain companies that are constantly trying to like push like, you know, the envelope and like trying to like constantly try new things, right? I feel there's one question that I want to follow up, like, with all of this, right? Like, so great, Airbnb has decided to, like, maybe sunset the React Native usage. But I think a subtle nuance is, like, you're not necessarily recommending that React Native never be used again, right? There are still some class of apps that might benefit from using just React Native even today, right? Do you think that's fair, or do you think... I mean, I don't want to necessarily be, like, apologetic for, like, the use or, like, not the lack of use of React Native, but I just want to make it clear. In your opinion, do you still think there is a class of app that would benefit from going purely React Native even today?
Yes, absolutely I would. Although I would say that people have asked me over and over again, especially after this blog post, they describe some, you know, a 3-sentence description of their team, and then they're like, okay, should we use React Native?
Should we use React Native?
And then that's really, I hope that it's clear both from this podcast and from the Medium post that it's a really complex issue. You really have to understand the pros and cons and the specifics of your team and your goals, and make a decision specific to your team. It really does matter. I think, and one of the things about React Native is that it's always changing. It's improving. It's getting better. Facebook is making changes. I think especially recently they've acknowledged a lot of these challenges. I think they've, you know, we've heard from them that they've experienced a lot of the challenges that we've experienced internally. And so it's a priority for them to fix these as well. I mean, I think over time, a lot of the things that are challenging today, like recycler views, and maybe even in bridging and some other technical challenges, are going to get easier over time. And once those become easier, I think some of the organizational issues may follow. So one of the things that I was afraid of by publishing this blog post is that if it was too negative, it could be a real detriment for the community. And that would essentially, the only effect that would have would be to squander innovation and hurt morale and prevent people from wanting to work on it. I think, and given the right investment, I think that there's a very bright future ahead for React Native. I think that there's a number of challenges that they have to figure out first, but if they get there, it can only be a good thing for the community. So I'm excited to continue following React Native, and I certainly wouldn't count it out for a project in the future.
I think that's, like, a really good sort of point to sort of wind it down, because I feel like you've hit the right spot about, you know, what went well, what didn't go well, and at the same time, why you have made a different choice, which is not necessarily to ding the technology per se, but just why you have made this choice now, right? And by you, obviously, I mean Airbnb. Thank you so much for all of this. This is incredible. This is so much information, and I know we could keep going on and on because there's so many subtle points that we touched that I knew we could maybe have, like, an independent episode for each one of this stuff. But I imagine you'd probably have to go back and start working on, like, the next new technology at Airbnb.
Gotta go again. Mavericks out the door.
Yeah, I know. So if folks want to, like, you know, stay tuned to, like, some of the cool stuff that you're doing, or, like, you know, some of the new stuff, what is a good way for people to keep a tab on you?
Yeah, so I'm accessible on Twitter. My Twitter handle is gpeal8. It's gpeal8. I'm happy to answer any questions. I know, you know, we've been here for a while in this podcast, but I think there's so many specific questions and more things that we could talk about. So if you have any questions or are curious or just want to share your thoughts about React Native, please do not hesitate to get in touch there.
Dan, I've heard you've been working on this secret Swift Native library. If folks want to contact you about that, what's a good way to do that?
Funny thing is, I've been spending way more time in JavaScript than I have been in anything iOS or ever related. But anyway, if folks want to contact me, they can reach me at Don Felker on both Twitter and Instagram. And Kaushik, if folks want to see what you're using React for, how can they reach you?
I am Kaushik Gopal on Twitter and on Instagram as well. So thank you all so much for listening. Gabriel, as always, it's a pleasure to have you on the show, and we can't wait to have you back again when you talk to us about the new cool thing that Airbnb is going to, like, hop on.
Likewise. Thank you guys so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
All right.
Ooh.
That was a marathon.
Yes.
I loved it. Yeah, yeah.
We can keep going. I don't know. It's...
That's it for the show, folks. Fragmented is hosted by Don Felker and me, Kaushik Gopal. We edit and produce all the episodes here on Fragmented. Sarah the Amazing Jackson from the Spec Network helps with production assistance and wraps our final mix. Our theme and ad music is by the national recording artist Blueprint from Weightless Recordings. You can find more Fragmented episodes at fragmentedpodcast.com. Thanks for listening, and we will catch you in the next episode.